And hello again, everybody. A few minutes ago, you just heard my voice, and you've probably had far, far too much of that today, but we are actually going to give you another hour and a half of, hopefully not so much my voice, but our returning co-host to the show, Verbal, to continue a topic that we started episode 162, actually, I believe. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And this is episode 164, the second episode of today's doubleheader. For those of you listening to us live on the stream, we hope you're enjoying 3 hours of all hacking goodness. And for those of you on the podcast, well, I guess it doesn't really matter if these were back-to-back when they aired live on September 12, 2006 or not. So I guess, yeah, you really don't care, do you? So, since this is the second email of our doubleheader for this week, I think this is kind of cool doing 2 episodes back-to-back. I think this is kind of it feels like very much like a baseball, football, sports, you know, we're doing back-to-back episodes, we're pulling an all-nighter, I don't know, it just feels kind of weird. We've never done this before, so it's actually kind of cool. And since we're doing this...
Sports analogies, you lost me, sorry.
What's that?
Sports analogies, you lost me.
Yeah, you know, not surprisingly, they're lost on a lot of hackers and geeks are not into sports, but... Yeah, we won't insert any NASCAR jokes here. That was Duel's job to give me the NASCAR jokes. The continual left turn. Anyway, since we are on the second episode of the doubleheader, that means there's really no housekeeping this week except Verbal, unless you had something you wanted to bring up about the mentor program. How is that going?
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that a little bit. Right now, it's actually going really well. I'm getting a steady stream of people asking to participate in the program. But right now, we actually have a little imbalance of mentors and mentees. We need about 3 or 4 more mentors because I have some people waiting to be paired. So if you're listening to the show and you would like to donate your time to mentor someone, you know, whether it is Linux, or whether, you know, it's some programming or networking knowledge, whatever you feel you can offer, send me an email at mentorship@binrev.com and, you know, tell me. And, you know, it doesn't take too much time. It's just like 1 or 2 hours a week, and you just basically have to help your mentee and, like, you know, guide them and answer questions for them. So, you know, if anyone has time, it would be greatly appreciated.
And you don't have to be, and correct me if I'm wrong here, you don't have to be like this master know-it-all of every topic in the world. If you're a Java programmer, for example, for a living, and that's what you're really good at, then you can certainly mentor somebody because people are wanting to learn that particular skill. So you would absolutely be a great mentor.
Right. I mean, the whole point of this program is to facilitate, like, the exchange of, you know, ideas and, like, helping each other learn. So if you're good at one thing but you don't know anything about anything else, you know, that's fine. Just, you know, teach someone what you know, and then in turn someone else will teach you what they know.
Right, right. And, you know, like you, I think you mentioned this a couple episodes ago, too, and I completely am with you on this, as I'm looking forward to having someone else mentor me on topics that I'm not as familiar with. So it's a great way to share some of the things you are familiar with and learn some of the things that you are not. So it's definitely a cool program, and I don't know if we're going to have anything up by the time, maybe by the end of this upcoming week, we will have some pages up. I don't want to put us on a deadline or put you on the spot here, but we are working on getting some, getting the site to be a little bit more interactive with the mentoring program so that people are able to kind of get some ideas, share information with each other, and kind of watch the progress of some of the teams as they go along. So I think we're going to be working on that for the rest of this week. So I'm sure we'll make an announcement on the show as well as in the forums about that when it happens.
Yeah. So what I wanted to do is to put up like a wiki or some other type of, you know, dynamic webpage where teams that are participating in this program will put up like their syllabus and like their progress. So, you know, you can reference other people's information, and hopefully after a while we'll get a good collection of, like, coursework, you know, not coursework, but, like, a good collection of information for, like, oh, if you want to learn, like, you know, some particular thing and you either don't have time or your schedule is, you know, really weird, then you can just go on that site and follow what someone else has already done, you know?
Right. All right. And there's no point in answering the same questions multiple times, so maybe it'll turn into kind of a frequently asked questions repository of specific things.
Right.
And,
well, yeah,
and,
definitely.
But anyway, we'll see how that unfolds. This is all something we're kind of trying to figure out the best way to do, so keep your eyes open for that. And other than that, I don't have any housekeeping. And did you have anything else, or was that it?
Yeah, I think that's it.
All right, so we do have some email, though. I split the email up amongst the shows as I felt it was appropriate, and there's some email this week that I thought would be good for us, so let's check that out. Okay, and our first email this week comes from Bob. Bob says, I use Gmail, but I'm also curious to know how secure Gmail is, and is there a better solution? I like the ability of being able to check my emails from anywhere. I'll interrupt momentarily and say that pretty much any web mail client will give you the ability to access emails from anywhere. And personally, I use Yahoo Mail, which has, by default now, SSL connections. So that's one alternative that I'm familiar with. But to continue, he says, do I need software on my computer to encrypt emails, i.e. Thunderbird or Outlook, or can I do everything from the net? If I must encrypt from a program on the computer, what's the best choice, meaning which encryption software and email software are best? Side note, I've only listened to episodes 1 and 2, and the latest, number 162, which is the one that Verbal and I did, and I'd like to say that I've given some thought about the definition of a hacker. I know you're not allowing more discussion about the term hacker, or perhaps you've talked about it in other shows, which we have, and I'll find those in due time. All in all, here's my 2 cents worth. A hacker is anyone who analyzes systems for vulnerabilities. What they do with these vulnerabilities defines them as either black or white, or I'm sure he means black hat or white hat. And if you're too stoned to figure out what to do with the vulnerability, you're a gray hat hacker. All right, well, thank you, Bob, for the email. Tell you what, Verbal, since this is kind of a follow-up on last week where you were asking me and posing to the audience, you know, are you using secure email and encryption and stuff like that, why don't you field this one a little bit, specifically... Well, let's start with maybe the his first question is, do we need software on his computer to encrypt email, such as Thunderbird or Outlook, or can I do everything from the net? Why don't we start with that?
Okay. First of all, he was saying he was wondering how secure Gmail is, etc. You said that Yahoo has SSL. Do you know if that's SSL for the entire duration of the connection or just for the login?
I believe, yikes, actually that's a good question, and while you keep answering, I'm going to look that up.
Okay, so the thing with Gmail is, I think if I'm wrong, please email in and correct me, but I think that when you log in, your password is encrypted and it's not transmitted over clear text. But after you log in, I think everything else is done in clear text. So if you send an email... from Gmail without encrypting it or whatever, then, someone sniffing the wire will be able to see all the clear text things. Now, normally, let's say you're doing Thunderbird or Outlook or whatever, and you want to encrypt your emails, you can get some software GNU-PG or PGP or something like that. And then it will kind of be integrated into the app, and it will do it for you. You don't have to, do it the ghetto way where you run the command line tool and you, put in the text and you get out, an armored output where, then you copy and paste it. Now, with Gmail, there are plugins that you can use to encrypt your email. If you just go to Google and search for, Gmail encryption, you'll come up with multiple hits for encryption modules for Gmail. Now, but the thing is, you mentioned that you wanted to not have to install programs, or do whatever, and say you just wanted to check your email at a local cafe or wherever there's public internet access and have that be encrypted. That I don't think is possible because Gmail itself doesn't provide encryption. So even if you did get one of those web-based encryption add-ons for Gmail, you would have to download, say, a plugin at the very least for like your Firefox, and that'll do the encryption for you. Now, when you get the plugin, you might see a button, you know, and like some UI integrated in your Gmail, but that is not, you know, that's not going to be there if your browser doesn't have the plugin. So if you want to just go to some random place and check your email over the web, then I don't think you're going to be able to do that without installing any software. Now, definitely installing a plugin for Firefox is much easier than, you know, say, you know, doing Thunderbird or whatever, because, you know, you just install the plugin once and, you know, you don't have to worry about it. Now, the other thing you can do if you truly want to, you know, be mobile in that sense, is you can store stuff on like a USB key. Now, I know some public terminals don't let you plug in your USB stuff, but most of them, you know, if it's like a place where you're supposed to be using the computer, they'll let you plug in your USB drive because, you know, maybe like they'll have a printer service available or whatever. Now, if you do that, then you can install a program on your USB drive that'll do the encryption for you. Or maybe, you know, you can just install, I mean, you know, put a plug-in on the USB drive and install it wherever you go. But, you know, as for what you really want to do, like what you're asking, I don't think that's possible. Now, there are other alternatives for sending, you know, that do encryption. I think one of them is called Cryptmail, but I could just be lying. But there are definitely web-only solutions for sending encrypted mail. But the problem with those is, for some reason, even though it's all public keys and, like, you know, it's the regular PGP standard, you have to, like, for some reason, they only let you import and export keys in the same system. Like, the two that I've tried does this, and I think it's because they want you to get other people to use their email system, but there should be no reason why, you know, you have to do that.
I didn't realize that was the way it worked. I thought that they offered just the encrypted using your public key and everything. I didn't realize that you could only do that with other users. I thought it would accept any, but I really don't know. I did, however, look up, and Yahoo is exactly what we suspected, and that is that it only encrypts. It only sends the password through SSL, and then it goes back to an open connection. So your actual email contents would be sent in clear text.
Yeah, most of them do that.
Right. But Yahoo used to be that Yahoo even sent the password in clear text, and they had a secure option, but you had to go out of your way to go to the HTTPS URL
right.
to get to it. And now they do it by default. So they've at least taken a step in the right direction. But the problem is that when you're encrypting all this, it adds a little extra overhead to every packet, basically. It's going to be encrypted, which makes all the data a little bit larger. And it's not a big deal when it's just one account or a handful of accounts, but when you're a giant megalo corporation like Google Gmail or Yahoo Mail or MSN Hotmail or whatever, it adds up pretty fast when you've got millions of users, so it becomes a problem to encrypt everything. However, that's one of the drawbacks of using these public free webmail things. Now, you can always set one up yourself, Verbal, as you're well aware. You can always set up a webmail client of your own. You can use, there's Squirrel Mail, there's Horde, which I like. There's just too many to name that you can set up and run if you have your own server, and then you do have full control, and you can certainly encrypt all traffic going to your mail server. And that stands also if you're using, he mentioned in his email, needing special software like Thunderbird or Outlook. Well, those are just clients. With any client, most of them support secured methods of transport transport of your data. It's just properly configuring your server and setting it up to use it. So there are certainly options available, but you really have to have control of the server that you're interacting with. And when you're using one of these Gmail or something like that, then obviously you don't have that kind of control. So the only other thing is what I think you kind of alluded to earlier is And I was going to suggest the same thing, is a USB key and have your PGP key on it and encode or encrypt your individual email messages anywhere you go. But that's the
There should be... I mean, I've not looked into this, but it wouldn't surprise me if there was, like, a PGP online. Like, you can just put in your key, and then you can, you know, encrypt it on some web page. And if it doesn't exist, someone should just write it, because it'll be very useful, you know?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Something doesn't feel like it's that simple about that, though. I can't quite put my finger on it now on the spot, but it sure would be handy.
Well, I mean, it's like, you have PGP running on the box, so, you know, it's just like a web interface where you have the text, and you just pipe it to PGP, and it spits back out the encrypted message to you. I mean...
But you'd have to have your private key and your public key to be able to...
No, you would only need to do that if you want the website to decrypt your message for you. Not if you encrypt it. So if you just need to encrypt an email to someone, then you can just have their public key. Now, if you wanted to sign it, then, you know, you would have to give them your key.
Right, that's okay.
But, if you just want to encrypt it to someone, just you just need their public key, and then you're all set.
Yeah, for that, it seems like they're probably... There probably already is a website. If anybody knows of any, of course, email us, radio@benrev.com. I would love to bring that up on the next episode, because that would be very handy for our listeners and for myself as well.
Right.
So, now, at the end of the email, you talked about the definition of a hacker, and I don't want to spend too awful much time, because we have done that on multiple episodes before, but I think everybody's heard my rant of how I have a very... Not my rant, maybe so much my explanation, that I have a very liberal definition of the word hacker, as, you know, anybody who really thinks outside of the lines, who doesn't take no for an answer, who does not accept limitations of any kind in anything. So to me, it's not even, you know, people say hacker, you assume computer hacker, but to me, hacker means anybody who thinks outside of the box in any particular thing. It just so happens that usually they do end up being computer people. But did you have anything additional? Did you have any thoughts on that? Or?
Right. Well, so Bob said in his email that, you know, he was saying, like, someone who analyzes systems or vulnerabilities, and, you know, depending on what they do with it, they're either a black hat or a white hat. You know, like, so my definition of a hacker, if I did have one, because the other show on 162, I mentioned that I really don't like that word. But
right.
If I had to, you know, give a definition, it would definitely not be as liberal as yours. But
right.
The thing is, you know, I think Bob's definition is a little too, you know, narrow for my liking anyway. You know, because it's like, in his definition, it's just people who deal with, you know, system security, whether at the host level or at the network level. And, you know, security, as, you know, I assume he's mentioning, right, since he said vulnerabilities, I'm assuming he's mentioning, like, finding exploits. And then either patching them or, you know, finding holes and exploiting them, you know, it's like which side of the fence are you on. But I think there's more than that, you know, like, because I normally would include other fields like coding, like writing good and elegant and clever code as, you know, being hacking, or like, you know, even with like phone phreaking, which I know nothing about. But, you know, from knowing some of you guys who are really into that, you know, there's definitely element of hacking in there, you know, that mentality. So, I mean, to me, it's more of kind of like a personality trait, but I would limit it into, like, the field of technology. Like, I wouldn't, you know, call some, like, writer of novels who, like, does clever things with the prose a hacker.
No, I agree with that. Let me just to clarify, I'm not saying that a writer of clever prose or whatever, to use your example, is makes them a hacker, but I'm saying it has the fundamental hacking mindset, the potential of that person.
Right.
They think like a hacker. That's not to say that they are a hacker. Again, really, the word hacker only comes in when technology becomes involved, whether, again, it's phreaking, computers, programming, coding, scanning, system level, whatever. That's when the term hacker comes to describe them. But people can have the same hacking mindset. That's what I mean to say. I would never call someone who comes up with a new style of writing really a hacker per se, or somebody who comes up with a new... Well, let me ask you this, though, just for argument's sake. I didn't want to go into detail, but what about somebody like, say, a scientist who comes up with a new application of... I don't know, something that ends up being the building blocks to quantum computing. So they weren't directly involved in hacking, but they came up and invented a science that ended up turning to technology.
Well, I mean, see, that's the thing. Like, there's these gray areas. That's why I don't really like to talk about it and, like, define it. Because you can't really... I don't think you can put, like, succinct boundaries around what is and isn't a hacker. You know, like, in your case, you can definitely make arguments either way.
Right.
So it's like, I don't really have an opinion of that, you know?
Right, and actually I think that's a good point that you said, is you know, defining it, see, the thing is, the media and writers and everybody out there, they like to have definitions. It's another thing I hate about the business of the quote-unquote security industry and security professionals. They want to make up all these terms and labels and make up all these specific things that they can call something just to have a term or a buzzword. I hate buzzwords. They got to make up some textbook definition so that they can memorize it and therefore take an exam and become certified in it. So they have this need to define everything. I'm defining it only because people do question it and it helps explain it. But I agree with you 100% that there's no absolute definition of the word hacker. So I
okay.
think that's all we have to say on that. Let's move on. Again, we've beaten that horse dead on this show over the... 3+ years. Wow, that sounds weird to say that. 3+ years we've been doing the show. So we have one more email this week. This one comes from Prince Vegeta, who says, "Dear hackers, about having a backup phone system. I rely on my copper line and my free VoIP connection. If you subscribe to internet and cable TV, you get free VoIP connection with 600 minutes for calling locally, RDS networks, and 60 minutes for calling normal phones, ROM Telecom, the national phone company. Recently, a mobile phone company named Zapp, Z-A-P-P, introduced a new kind of phone service called Zapp Fixtel. In translation, fix means an old-fashioned phone that you can't carry around with you, but with a twist. They provide you with a phone that looks just like a normal copper-line phone, but without an antenna, much like an old mobile phone. Here's the catch. It is mobile. It has no cable. You could take it with you to work. Excuse me. You could take it to work, and you could carry it around, but that's not very practical because it's too freaking big. But in case of emergency, this new type of hybrid phone could prove useful because it's a new service and wouldn't get DOSed all when all the subscribers decide to use it at the same time." So he is obviously, or I'm thinking, he's probably listening to one of our recent episodes, the one that was called Technological Independence. Because on that show, we talked about having backups to all of the things that we've come far too reliant on. You know, if your cable modem goes out, are you going to be scrambling or shit out of luck because you can't check your email or because you can't make a phone call because your VoIP is out as well if your power goes out and things like that. So that's very, very cool. I think that's a really interesting setup, and I actually did a little looking into this, and obviously in the email itself you could tell that this was, when he mentioned the word translation, this is obviously not something from the United States. So I did a little looking, and this is actually in Romania. So where we have a large number of Romanian listeners, by the way, so shouts to Romania. You okay over there?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Alright, just making sure you're not dying on me on the phone. Now that would make great radio, but I don't want you to die on the phone. That would not be cool. We'd have the highest ratings ever, but come on now, stick with me. It's kind of cool that... It's actually kind of weird because usually what people are doing is having their VoIP line as their main line and then their copper as their backup. But in this case, you're ordering or having the original copper line and they're giving you the bonus of the VoIP internet connection, which is kind of cool with the number of minutes. And I'm certain that people are going to be using those minutes for their free long distance and stuff first, and their mobile minutes or whatever, however you want to call it. And the copper, I would imagine, wouldn't come into play until you've run out of those. So I think that's kind of a cool setup. What do you think the chances of that ever happening in the United States are?
Well, I don't think people care that much in the United States, to be honest.
Because
most people have a cell phone anyway, and... people don't like to think about that stuff in the United States. They're just like, ah, well, you have a phone. I mean, you know, I have a phone, it's fine. Like, most people I know don't even have a landline. They all just have cell phones.
Yeah, I know some
people
like that, too.
Like, it's a different crowd over here.
Yeah, you guys out on the West Coast are a little bit different. No, I know a lot of people that are in the same boat. They only have a cell phone, and quite honestly, I was so happy when I lived down in Fort Lauderdale down there in that area. I think I spoke on the show many times that how much I hated Bell South, which is our local telco, our baby Bell. And they required me to have phone service, basic phone service, to be able to get high-speed internet DSL through them, and my cable company didn't offer it yet. So when the cable company finally came along to offer it, yeah, I dropped my phone service completely and was on cell only for the longest time there. So, yeah, it's absolutely, but if you're going to make long-distance calls and you don't want to spend the kind of money you have to pay for a cell phone these days, I mean, you're right.
Skype for long-distance calls.
Well, yeah, you're assuming computer people, too. But like you said, it goes back to people in the United States, Americans, they don't care a whole lot, which is sad in a way. Apathy is my biggest pet peeve of all. But do you think they would suddenly care if their cable company or phone company came out and, instead of these bullshit fake bundled services where they save you $2 if you bundle shit together, you think if a company came up, similar to what this sounds like, that says, listen, we'll give you your cable, and we'll give you a copper line that's reliable that you can count on, and we'll give you VoIP minutes that you can use for your long-distance calls, cheap and easy. That certainly, the capability is certainly there. There's absolutely no reason why a company can't do that. I mean, let's take a cable company. They can obviously offer the high bandwidth cable modems. They can obviously offer VoIP, and many of them do, but they're looking at profit. They're not looking at the best interest of their customers. That's the difference between the United States and a lot of other countries. We are looking at the bottom line profit for the company, and there's not necessarily anything wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with making money exactly. But you cross a certain line where you're raping your customers. You're not looking out for the best interest of your customers. If a company were to pop up right now and offer these things at half the price, I'll give you cell phone coverage, I'll give you copper landline, I'll give you free unlimited long distance via VoIP and high-speed bandwidth and cable television, all for $75, you don't think Americans would suddenly get interested in that? I think they'd jump all over that.
Well, now, the thing is, okay, so the number one thing I think is, does it cost less? So the thing is, the cost, and then, like, the functionality or the features is a distant second. So let's say someone has some setup, like they get cable for cable internet and TV, and then they have a phone line, you know, for whatever reason. And if someone does that, you know, the question is whether or not it will be cheaper. Right?
Right.
Like, so, I mean, so in your scenario, are you saying that it will be cheaper or not?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I'm saying that right now, my cable company for the setup that I just described to you would cost easily $150 to $200. And I'm saying that right now, they could do that for half the price.
It would be cheaper, right?
I'm saying
someone came in and, you know, replaced existing services.
Yes.
Right. So, I mean, if it's cheaper, I think most people, that's enough for them. And, you know, if you tell them that they can do the same thing that they did before, but for cheaper, then most people would just do it for that fact alone.
Right.
And
exactly
in addition,
point.
You know, if you're trying to put out additional functionality and features, like, they might get excited about that, but, you know, most people are not going to care. So if it's cheaper, people are going to switch.
No, exactly my point was the bottom line is price. Ironically, and maybe that is an American thing. And maybe that is an American thing, that ironically, the companies are looking at trying to make the most possible money they can and raping the customers for every little dime. And the customers, on the other hand, are looking to save every little dime. So, yes, the price matters to the customers as well. There is no in-between. There's no compromise. There's no happy medium where the company says, well, we're going to try to give you all these services at a little bit less price, and and American consumers would say, oh, well, I'll take that. You know, it's worth it if the company's trying, if they're a good company, if they're conscious of their customers, et cetera. There's no balance. There's no acceptable middle ground. So it's two extremes competing, and Americans are going to go for the absolute cheapest price, period. That's why VoIP has been slow to adopt, is because Americans are skeptical of it. And then, as word has gotten around that VoIP is, and I use this word hesitantly, reliable, it's kind of reliable compared to regular phone lines, or cell phones, the same way. All of a sudden, when people start adopting them, that bell curve took a giant leap of in number of people adopting them. So once people realize and start trusting this and realize they can save money, then it can happen. Now, the problem with the scenario I gave, and I know I'm spending too far time on this, but this is one of my sore spots, so I'm going to rant a little bit about this, is the simple fact that the scenario I mentioned of a new company coming in and forming and giving that same stuff for $75, $100 with all of the... Could you imagine all your utilities, your phone, not all of them, of course, your phone, your cable television, your cable internet, high-speed internet, and a copper phone line, and your cell phone, all of that for $100, which to me would be freaking fantastic. That'll never happen because, oh man, I don't want to turn this into a big government rant, but it is. The government won't allow that company to come in and exist because they overregulate everything.
You know, the United States is a place where people rather have quantity over quality, right? You know, we would rather have 6 cheeseburgers for $3 than have, like, an actual real meal. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, with that mentality, you know, if something is crappy or whatever, just as long as they market it decently and they can convince you, it'll probably be about the same. And it costs less, then people are going to use it. Like, okay, let me tell you a quick story. I was talking to my mom the other day, and, you know, since I do computers for a living, she asked me, like, okay, she said, there's some, the cable company is, like, telling us about this new phone service that they're rolling out, and, you know, it's cheaper by $2, and one of the features is if the power goes out, your phone will still work. And she's trying to explain all these things to me, basically like reading me the brochure, and I had no idea what she was talking about. Mm-hmm. And then after like 15 minutes, I realized she was talking about VoIP, right? And you know, and I was like, well, I don't know, you already have a phone, and it works, whatever. But, so she switched because it was $2 less, and when the power goes out, you can still use your VoIP service. But the thing is, like, so after that, I hung up and I was like, okay, well, I don't really care. She can switch over to VoIP, you know, it'll be cool because maybe I can, like, tap an Astros phone off their place and mess around with it. But then I realized, like, if you have a regular phone and your power goes out, your phone still works because the phone company gives you power. So it's like, wow. These features, like, you don't even need to have them be new and real. It's like, just say things that sound good and people will buy it. Like, people don't think about these things.
Nope.
So just have as many bullet points and make it cheaper and people will adopt it.
Well, that's all about marketing, yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to take off my tinfoil hat now and let's get into the actual main content of the show, shall we? Because we actually kind of left off episode 162. We kind of ran out of time. I do think it wasn't such a bad stopping point, though, but I do think we need to do a little bit of a recap of how we ended that episode. That episode, we were going to go into a little bit more detail about, I guess we'll call it secured communications, for lack of a better term. But basically, we found a good stopping point after defining tunneling and what tunneling is, the concept of tunneling. So, and by the way, I don't know if you're getting good reception on the phone there or whatever, but if you're, you're kind of garbling up a little bit. But I'm going to let you talk about, can you give us like a, obviously we don't want to rehash the whole that episode, but maybe give us a quick recap of tunneling concepts. I think it's important that we readdress the stack and how tunneling works, because it is going to become relevant in the rest of this episode of the show. So can you give them a quick recap on that?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Okay, so let's do this. Now, for tunneling, you basically, so I don't want to use the same word, but basically you're transporting packets that you actually want to send, but you're disguising them as another type of packet. So with the example that I used last time for DNS, you know, tunneling IP over DNS, you have this network stack, and all it is the order that your headers go on in a packet. And it's a stack because it's, you know, first in, last out. Now, what that means is you have these abstraction layers, right? So we talked about the physical layer, the link layer, and then the, you know, the IP layer, and then layer four, which is transport. Now, when you send a DNS packet, you have a normal DNS packet would have those four layers, and then it would have the actual DNS content. Now, that the DNS content is the payload. Now, in certain situations, like we're talking about the application of that, you know, airports and such, they let you transport DNS packets openly. So that means, you know, they don't really care about the source and destination address, but it's more about the port, because the port is to the firewall is what defines, you know, this is a DNS packet. You know, because most firewalls won't look in the actual packet in itself to make sure that, you know, it fits the DNS payload. So what they do then, I mean, what you do then, is you replace the payload with another type of packet, one that you actually want to send. So in your regular DNS packet, you have those four headers, you know, the regular headers that you have. Then you have your other packet. But that packet also has its own headers. You know, that packet will have its own IP layer and its own, you know, transport layer and whatever else you have after that. Now, notice that when you do the tunneling and you tack on your own packet behind the original DNS packet, you don't need to put the physical layer and link layer. And that's because when the proxy on the other side gets that packet, it's already in the kernel at that state. So you don't need the two lowest physical layers. You just need the one that has, like, the important information, like the IP address and then the port, et cetera, et cetera. Right. Now, so what we're saying is after you tack your own packet onto the end of the DNS packet and use that as a payload, you send it from your machine. Now, when you hit the firewall or whatever security measures you have at the airport, it's going to look and say, oh, this is an IP packet from someone, you know, with an IP inside the network, and it's going to go out on, you know, port 53, I think, is DNS. I don't remember.
I think it's
going to go out to the port. Now,
okay, all right, hold on. Verbal. Hold on just a second. You're breaking up really bad. So
okay.
I don't want to, and it's kind of an important part there. So let's back up just a little bit. What you're doing here is wrapping up that packet. Let's go back to there. And are you getting a good signal there? You're on the cell, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's back up about 10 or 15 seconds because you went completely garbled on us. Maybe the feds didn't like our comments about All right, so back up just a few seconds and say that again.
Where do you want me to start?
All right, just let's go back to you were saying that you do not need the physical layer information because the proxy server is going to handle that.
Okay. Now, keep in mind when you have put on your own packet, you only need layer 3 and up. You don't need to put in the physical layer and the link layer, because once that encapsulated packet gets to the proxy server on the other side, you know, that packet goes from the wire up to the OS kernel already. So once it gets to your proxy server, you know, you don't need to have the, like, hardware addresses and all that stuff, because it's supposedly already processed by the kernel. So you only need important things like the IP addresses and then the port numbers. So when someone, you know, when you're a client at the airport, for example, and you send that packet out, the firewall at the other end is going to look and say, okay, this is the IP packet, and then it's going to look at the port and be like, okay, this is the DNS port, so I'm going to allow it, because it has to allow other legitimate users to have access to DNS so they can, you know, bring up their freaking login page or whatever, right?
You can't realistically block the DNS port.
Right. So, I mean, most firewalls at mediocre security places will block based on ports and source IPs and destination IPs. Like, it's not going to go through every packet and look at the payload and validate that, you know, it's a legitimate DNS packet. Right?
Right, unless they have some kind of packet shaping, and yeah, most places aren't doing any of that stuff.
Right, because I mean, you know, it takes significantly more hardware and more resources to look at the application layer of every single packet, like, because you have to run processing on it, and you're probably not going to have that code in the kernel, then you have to kick it up to user space. Like, they're not going to do that. You know, like, maybe
right.
Some super fancy place will have it in hardware, like some Cisco box or whatever. But, like, most establishments are not going to have that. So if you can tunnel with the appropriate port, then you should be all set.
Right.
And that's pretty much the whole story about tunneling is encapsulate an existing packet with another. Now, the important thing to remember is you have this now funky network stack that no one understands except for you, right?
Well, you and your proxy server.
What you need to do is choose... have a proxy server on the other end that understands this so it can proxy for you and decapsulate your packet and send out your actual packet and get whatever information you need.
Right, right. And as long as, it's kind of like, this is probably a terrible metaphor, but it's kind of like when you're a kid and you had that secret code with your friend that only he knew what you were saying and what to do with it or how to interpret it. It's you and your proxy server that are the only ones that are going to, again, if they have the packet shaping or the, like you said, maybe some high-end Cisco device, but those are expensive and people don't have them, they could really, it is plain text. And maybe this is a good segue to talk about some other things that are related to this, is encrypting or encrypted communications, which some forms of them work similarly. They are forms of tunneling. Is that an accurate statement? Well, specifically
I mean,
VPN,
like,
is what I'm getting at.
When you have VPNs, right?
Right.
So the idea of a VPN, which is a virtual private network, is you have boxes at geographically, separate locations. I mean, it doesn't even have to be geographically, but it's like you're on different networks, and you want them to appear like they're on the same network. So, I mean, I'm sure everyone is familiar with, like, use cases for VPN. Like, if I'm working from home today, then I want to VPN into my work. Then from their end or from someone else that's in the corporate network, my machine looks like it's supposed to be there and it's plugged in at some place.
Right.
Now, to do that, right, you can implement a form of tunneling. Now, there's, many existing technologies for this, and tunneling is only one of them. But mostly what happens is there's a level of encryption involved, right? You make some sort of connection from yourself, and make it to some entry point in the network you want to be a part of, right? Now, ideally, to be secure, that connection is secure because the whole point is you don't trust whatever is, in between you and the place you're trying to VPN into. So usually the case is the internet, right? Now, the first thing you do, every single VPN has some sort of authentication mechanism at the entry points to make sure, you're supposed to be there. So usually there's a firewall that sits, on the corporate network at the edge. And if you want to VPN in, then you have to authenticate with the firewall. So that stuff is implemented by like Radius, like AAA Radius, I'm sure you've heard of that, and like PAM, the authentication module stuff.
Right.
They use that for everything.
Right.
Now, so that takes care of the authentication. Now, if you've ever used a VPN client before, when you start it and you authenticate, then you kind of, some magic happens, and your box now has access to, other addresses inside the corporate network.
Right.
And I'm going to talk a little bit about, you know, how that's actually done.
Well, yeah, we got to address IP authentication and IP resolution. As far as I think we should clarify here that there's a before and after. You said it, but let me just simplify here that or make a clear point anyway that before you connect to your VPN, you're going to get whatever IP address has been assigned to you by either your dial-up provider, your cable modem, whatever. You've got an IP address in their subnet. And when you establish this VPN communication, as Verbal said earlier, you're establishing a handshake and you're being reassigned an IP address because you are now looking on the, at least within that VPN, you are a part of that network where the VPN resides, which is why the term virtual private network, and you're becoming part of that network. And if you'll check, your IP address is now resolving to something internal to the network. So, and it's very, very common in corporate environments, which is probably the way we're going to emphasize or talk about this, because internally, let's say you have an internal documentation folder where you store all your official documentation. And the way that you keep people out of that, the one of the security methods you have in there is IP resolution, IP authentication. Where only people that come from my local internet, well, I don't know, 147.147.147.x. Anybody within that has access to it, or whatever your address range. Of course, I'm making stuff up now. But whatever your address range is, well, when you're VPN'd in, as far as the network is concerned, you are now within that range, and you can access all those internal things, even though you are at home VPN'd into that system. So understand IP authentication and how that falls into play of the whole thing, because you're not really the same computer anymore. I don't know how to put that into words. Is it making sense?
Well, yeah, okay. So maybe I'll be more clear if I talk about how that actually happens and, like, how the actual packet is sent.
Okay.
Okay. So, now, normally, when you send a packet from your computer and you don't have a tunnel, not a VPN, you know, configured, you have your own IP and you have your own transport layer, you know, if there is a transport layer for the protocol you're using. Now, so don't worry about the physical link layer. That just sends a packet out to your gateway. Like, that is just for getting it over the wire. So all the interesting routing stuff happens with the IP, starting at the IP layer. Now, when you are, you know, when you're routing a packet, you need the source and destination address so you know where it's going, right? Now, when you do that for your computer, it has a certain IP address, right?
Right.
Now, when you're doing that for a VPN, so you have to get your packet from your computer to the gateway over to that all the way to the other side, right? But the virtual part comes in because once it gets to the other side, to the VPN way, the VPN looks at that packet and, like tunneling, it takes away all the other stuff as the IP and layer and transport layer of your original packet. And what you have in there is a whole new packet, and that second IP and transport layer header contains your IP for, you know, your virtual IP address.
Right.
And your, you know, whatever other application you're using.
Excellent. Excellent explanation.
So, right. Now, on the other side, like, what actually happens is you have a virtual interface. So, I mean, depending on the OS and the VPN client you're using, if you do like ifconfig or ipconfig in Windows, you'll see different things. But you still have an IP address on your local network, but you'll have a virtual address that has an IP, whether they display it or not. They have a virtual IP that is for the VPN. Now, most clients will do full tunneling and not split tunneling, and I'll get in a second. But most VPN clients will tunnel all your traffic over the VPN. So what they do is your computer has a default like interface that it sends stuff to, and it'll send it to the virtual interface, and that virtual interface will have code that is going to put in headers for other, you know, for your virtual identity in the corporate network or whatever you're VPNing into. Then that virtual interface will link up to the physical interface. So once, you know, the virtual interface is done with putting in, you know, the virtual info on it, that's a valid packet, but not for your local network. You should, when you send it out through the physical, like the real interface, then that interface, code, you know, code in the kernel will tack on IP headers and other headers for that interface. So when it goes out, you'll have the, you know, encapsulated packet.
Right, and this is basically the VPN server that you're talking here is very much a parallel to the proxy server we described in tunneling on that previous episode and earlier in this episode. They're both doing the similar things. It's just that you're not necessarily tunneling on the DNS layer this time or the DNS packet types. This is just virtualizing the whole process, I guess.
Right.
It's an encrypted
when
proxy.
When you do that, you will obviously use more bandwidth because you have extra headers. But, you know, so, you know, sometimes you VPN to stuff and it's slower, but, you know, that's why it's happening. Now, when I was saying, like, if you use some program, like VPN client, they'll tunnel all your connections. Now, Stank, have you used any VPN clients, like, you know, in for work or whatever?
Absolutely. I use them on a daily basis, regularly.
What VPN client do you use?
Multiple ones, and I can't drop too many docs or anything, but in my line of work, I have to... Security is a big aspect of it, so whatever different clients use at their different sites is what I use. So I have to be flexible to use me. But let's go with Cisco for if you want a specific example or something.
Right. So now, when you use, I mean, for any of your VPN clients, does it tunnel all of your traffic over the VPN?
Well, and actually, I think that's a good question for everybody. Every one of them is different, so I can't really give you a straight answer. Some do, some don't.
Right.
But I think this is very excellent, and I think we should emphasize this that. Let me actually ask the question back to you. Does it matter? What is the difference between split or full tunneling?
Okay, so the explanation I had before was for a full tunneling. So that means that no matter what you do, you know, let's say I'm tunneled into, you know, AOL.com because I work there for some reason, which I don't, by the way.
God help
but
you.
I tunnel in there, then after I do that, all of my traffic, you know, will go through the corporate network. Now, I might be working at home and I want to, you know, check my email, but I'm also surfing child porn or whatever, you know. But all of that stuff will go through the corporate network, and if your corporate network has any type of monitors, then they'll see that. So, you know, make sure you're aware of what kind of tunneling is going on.
When you're surfing for child porn. Let's just back it up to regular porn, can we?
Oh, okay. I'm just saying for the sake of argument, because I don't work at AOL.
It was funny.
But
I got
I'm saying this is all fictitious.
Okay. Well, AOL and child porn go hand in hand. I think we all know that. But anyway...
Okay, so the other thing is split tunneling. Now, for tunneling, what happens is, you know, if I'm at my house and I turn it on, all the traffic that goes to AOL subnets or, you know, AOL.com domain name will be tunneled over through the connection, but everything else will go over my regular local network connection, whatever that may be.
Right.
Now, when you do that, like, that might sound better from, you know, whatever point of view that I was coming from with the porn and stuff and checking work email. But keep in mind, when you do that, you're kind of gapping a bridge. Like, you're creating, your computer becomes a bridge from the outside internet and the inside secure corporate network.
Well, Well, that, now, that doesn't sound very secure. That sounds
right,
like a problem.
So that's why a lot of places don't do that. Like, I mean, a lot of solutions don't allow you to do that because, you know, they're already enough trouble as it is with people, you know, taking their laptops from work and going home and, like, browsing MySpace ever and getting malware and viruses installed and coming back to work and, like, nothing happened and then plugging into the corporate network.
Right.
Now,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
But, yeah, but split tunneling does have its, you know, benefits, right? Now, if you can, you know, guarantee your box is secure or somehow have separation of, you know, permissions, like if for some reason your email client is jailed and, like, that's the only thing running that's using the split tunneling, then, like, yeah, whatever, you know?
Well,
but, I mean, there are pros and cons to each, and you just need to understand them and decide what solution works for you.
Yeah, and that comes back, and it's why I wanted to mention earlier about the IP authentication, because it has to know what you're trying to reach and what IP block it's in and what your virtual IP block is, and that's how it can know whether it's going to take you through the VPN tunnel or take you to the outside internet through your normal paths.
Right. Exactly.
Now,
well, I mean, actually, oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to throw out a couple questions if I can. I don't want to stop you if you're like for example.
No, go for it.
Yeah, here. All right, just to clarify, if I'm on a full tunneled VPN, every single thing that I browse, every single packet I send, if I check my personal POP3 mail account through my something, I go browse some websites, I chat with somebody online, all of those packets in a full tunneling situation are all going to go through that VPN server, correct?
Yes,
all of them.
Correct.
Now, they are encrypted, which is great, but are they, well, actually, how about this? Let's play the conspiracy theory here. Can the administrator, the server of that VPN machine, can they see and track all of my traffic?
Yes,
so,
unless you encrypt it. But, like, let's say you send an encrypted email via Gmail.
Right.
Then they won't be able to see that, because that's application layer encryption.
Right, because if I PGP encrypt it, for example.
Right. They'll see that you connected to Gmail and you executed some command and that you probably, you know, sent an email. But the contents of the email are encrypted and, you know, they won't be able to get that unless they have the key.
All right. Well, let's go a step further here and play what if. What if I had a second VPN server? Can I chain them together and VPN into box A? Then box A has a VPN connection set up to box V. Let's say that's up and running constantly. I connect to box A, which then connects to box B, and then box B is going to go out and do whatever traffic I want, receive it, send it back to box A, and then back to myself. A, is that possible? And B, are there any benefits or reasons to do that?
Now, what is box B? Like, what networks are they in? Now, are you saying, like, your work is box B?
Let's say box B is, all right, I'm going to make up a totally hypothetical situation. Let's say box B is, let's use AOL, for example. And AOL, that's their VPN box. Box A is, let's say I'm a security consulting firm, and I have a box that needs to access all of the AOL stuff so I can do my security work. That would be box A. And
right.
Me, my sitting at home with my laptop, I want to VPN to box A so that I can then subsequently get into box B. Let's say they don't want me or don't allow me to directly get into box B.
Yep.
Is that possible? And if so, is there any advantage or reason for doing that?
Yeah, I mean, that is possible, and people do that. So what you're saying, right, is that you VPN into box A, right? That's
right.
Your consulting company.
Right.
And you know, like that kind of permission, like contract, I guess you can say, between you, yourself, and the company you work for is one thing. Now, box A, which is at your consulting company, box B, which is AOL.com, for example, mm-hmm. they will have another things set up. You know, they'll have another kind of, you know, if they're doing some project, they'll have their own permissions set up and everything. And that VPN, right, is a different set of, you know, I'm not getting the right word here, but that VPN is something completely different than, you know, the permissions that you have with from you and your own company.
Right.
Right? So then what ends up happening is you tunnel your packet to box A, and then they rip off the headers, you know, that are that went over the internet, and then that packet's floating around in the corporate network, and if it's destined to go to AOL.com in box B, that will be re-encapsulated, so it will be sent from the VPN link from your consulting company into onto AOL.
All right, that's the word I wanted to hear. Does it get, and I'm on, this is an honest question, I really don't know the answer to this, does it get re-encapsulated, or does it get cumulatively encapsulated? Does it add that second layer of encryption to an already encrypted packet?
No, so from the description that you gave me,
right,
it doesn't accumulate it. It decrypts it first, so you have your packet floating around.
I see.
In your corporate network, and then if, you know, at some point it needs to be encapsulated again, then it will go over again to, you know, because, like, what you probably have is you'll have two gateways, one for authentication with your, you know, working from home people, and another gateway for AOL.com. Now, you can set it up so it does that. Now, if you do that, the routing will be a little more complicated, and I'm not sure if there is a legitimate use case for it, but you can
right.
do that.
Well, I'm wondering if they're encrypted cumulatively, and I'm sure there's probably some business buzzword that I'm supposed to know that I don't. But
the thing is,
re-encrypts.
You're basically daisy chaining
right.
the proxies.
And I'm thinking that by doing that, like the first packet that goes to my box, if it then gets encrypted again before it goes to the AOL box, maybe they would not see the original content. They would only see the secondary content because the first one is still encrypted. But, you know, I'm probably going a little bit into weird scenarios that would never happen in a real-world environment. So let's back up a little bit. There's one other thing I wanted to talk about with tunneling, if I may, that I think our listeners might be interested in, and it's something that more people might want to use. And it kind of goes back to our first example of the DNS tunneling. And that is SSH tunneling. Would this be an appropriate time to bring that up or talk about that?
Okay, yeah. I mean, so SSH tunneling is an application level tunneling. Now, with, you know, even with VPN, you can VPN in layer 2, and you can also VPN in from layer 3. Now, for say using buzzwords, right, VPNing in layer 2 is what they use IPsec for that. So I'm sure you've heard of IPsec.
Of course.
Layering in layer... Yeah, okay, I'm fine. So for IPsec, your IP address is actually encrypted. So this is the tunneling mode that we, you know, have been assuming the whole time. So you know how you're going to end up having two IP headers, right?
Right.
So the first one, when it goes from your box to the VPN gateway, that is unencrypted. Because, I mean, that goes over the untrusted, you know, untrusted internet or whatever.
Right.
But your second layer, your second IP layer, that will be encrypted, and only the VPN gateway on the other side will be able to decrypt that. So, you know, people who are sniffing are not going to be able to see any addresses from your corporate network and, you know, potentially, like, services you have, et cetera, and open ports leaked out into the public internet.
Right. It's not right? just the payload that's encrypted. It's the entire packet, IP address
right.
included. Right.
Right. Because, you know, because it's like... you have, you know, you're connecting to the VPN, and we mentioned the mechanism, you know, to actually get the packet over there, but we didn't really talk about, you know, the security part. And, you know, that part is pretty plain. You just encrypt it, you know, with AES or whatever new fandangled encryption algorithm you have.
Right.
Okay?
Yep.
Now, the other thing is you can encrypt in a higher level, which is you can use SSL. Now, when you do that, only the actual data is encrypted. So if I were sniffing your traffic and you were using an SSL encryption, then I would be able to see IP addresses that are in the corporate network and, like, what ports you're sending to and stuff.
Right. So that's more appropriate for web access type when you just want the contents encrypted.
Right. So, you know, that would be cool if you're, like, connecting to a web proxy or whatever.
Right. Or actually what we were started off the episode when I was talking about Yahoo Mail. It goes through SSL to encrypt just the password when I log in to be protected so my password is not sniffed. But people can certainly still see from the rest of the packet information that I was going to mail.yahoo.com or whatever the server you're going to is. That's still in plain text that could be sniffed out of the air, but you could never get the actual password.
Right.
So
exactly.
So it's a choice of how much security do you need.
Right. So now the other thing, so you're asking about SSH tunneling, right?
Right.
And, I mean, people love that because it's easy. You know, everyone has SSH installed. And, you know, there's the group who develops it really made it very versatile. And, you know, it can do a lot of things. But keep in mind that when you do SSH tunneling, that is an application layer tunneling. So that's not even at layer 3 or layer 4. Like, you're tunneling in, you know, the actual application layer. So what happens is you set up a tunnel on, you know, the SSH. So you know how when I was talking about you have, like, a virtual interface on your computer that you send all your packets to that you want to go over the VPN, and that virtual interface will, like, put on the headers for you for, like, your virtual identity, and then it'll encrypt it, and then that mess will be put into, you know, the actual header of, like, your local network.
Right.
Right? So that so now for SSH tunneling, pretend that virtual interface that does the encrypting, the adding of the headers, imagine that is the entry point for your SSH application. So when you do SSH tunneling, that is the functionality your SSH is providing for you. So if, you know, I set, like, a forwarder for my SSH, like, let's say I set a local forward and I, you know, SSH into some gateway, and if I set a local forward in the command options, then, you know, for, like, okay, local port, like, you know, 31337 is going to tunnel to, like, some other place, then what happens is, when I send packets to that local port, it's going to instead go through SSH, and SSH is going to encrypt it for me, and now your quote-unquote VPN gateway is going to be the SSH server on the other side. And whatever you're sending is going to go into the other side, and it's going to be shot out in the direction that you specified in your command line. So if you said, tunnel all my connections and my packets from, you know, this local port on my machine to, like, port, you know, 80 on some remote machine, right, that the SSH server can access, then the SSH server on the other side is going to tack on the appropriate headers so your packets will get routed to the correct place remotely. So that's exactly what, you know, a VPN does in a, you know, from a logical perspective, but it's at different layers and it uses different encryption schemes.
Right. Now, are there other schemes or other protocols besides IPsec and SSL?
Right, yeah. So, I mean, there's a whole slew of them. Because the thing is, you know, all you have to do is logically create a connection to the VPN gateway, and you need a mechanism to do the tunneling and, like, the encapsulation for you, and you need a mechanism to encrypt the packet that's your payload. Now, there are many, you know, ways to do this, and some of them are like PPTP, which is a point-to-point connection, and L2TP, which is a layer 2 tunneling protocol, and L3TP version 3, which is layer 3 tunneling, and MPLS, to name a few. But all of these is to, you know, establish, it's a tunneling protocol to establish connectivity between you and the VPN gateway, right? Because you need to have some sort of protocol that tells you, you know, how to, like, what kind of header to have to identify this packet that you're sending with, you know, what you use to encrypt it on the other end, and like what packet order, I mean, what header order in the packet you expect to see and all that stuff. Now, you don't really have to worry about that if you're not going to be, like, rolling your own VPN implementation. If you're just going to use something, then you don't need to know, you know, how, like, you know, or which protocol it's using. But if you want to, like, you know, hack it or reverse engineer it, then you definitely need to know how that protocol operates. And, you know, if you are, you know, for example, right, if you're using IPsec or some L2 tunneling thing, then you're going to need to know that the IP address for the virtual network is not going to be exposed to you and all that stuff, right?
Right. And that's
so,
all, yeah.
I mean, one last thing that I want to throw out there is if you're using a VPN of any sort, you know, make sure your, you know, your security on your box is really good that you're SSHing into, or, I mean, VPNing into, because, I mean, your box is, like, on multiple networks at different times, right?
Right.
And, like, your box is pretty much a slut, so you have to protect it, or else, you know, if you just go to, like, Starbucks or whatever and use the network there, you know, the security and the risk involved is much greater, and if you bring that stuff back into wherever your VPNing is, then, you know, you're screwing over everyone on that network.
So you'll give your box a venereal disease? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, seriously, it's just like sex in a very boring way.
Wow, that was a great way to end the segment there. Actually, you know what? I'm kind of looking over the notes here, and I want to go back to split tunneling. We've got a few minutes, so go back to split tunneling for a second.
Okay.
I think maybe another good example or a good application that might be worth mentioning. Again, split tunneling is when you're only traffic going to a certain IP range or a certain domain resolution, whatever you want to call it, is encrypted, but everything else to the rest of the global interweb that doesn't need to go to that domain is sent through whatever your standard is. Now, isn't it in fact true that you may find yourself with the need to connect to a different IP resolved address from the same computer at the same time securely? So
you mean like have two VPN connections?
That's what I'm getting at, yes.
So you can do that, and that does happen. But like most, if not all, of the VPN software out there doesn't allow you to do that out of the box because it's complicated. And your OS has to support, you know, that kind of tunneling. Okay, actually, so a good example is to tell you what I'm doing or what I want to set up at my house so you can get, you know, a better idea of what's involved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have, okay, so there are a couple ways to log into my work. One of them is I can SSH into some gateway they have and then can, you know, pipe everything through that. Now, that's a good, you know, that's a decent way to do it, but it's annoying because every single, you know, service I want to use, I have to tunnel it. So it's like if I want to use some web page, I have to create a local tunnel on SSH, and I have to, like, actually, you know, say in the command line, you know, whatever I send to a local port, do that. I have to set up the port.
All right, so you're saying that, I think I might have interrupted you there. I think you were saying that it's kind of a pain because you have to tunnel, when you do the SSH tunneling, you have to specify every individual port that you want to tunnel, which is kind of a hassle, right?
Right, right. So the other thing I can do is I can use the VPN client. Now, if I use the VPN client and, you know, it's a full tunnel client, so it's not split. So all of my traffic goes over you know, the corporate network. And, you know, that's not good for reasons I previously mentioned. You know, so it's like if I want to, you know, play some music off my share from my computer, I can't do that. Now, what I want to do is to set up split tunneling. Now, there's a lot of ways to do this, but this is what I'm going to do. Now, we can get a router, like a dinky little Cisco, like 800 series router, and we can get that to set up as a full tunnel. So I plug that into the wall, and that router will create a VPN connection with my work. And then if I plug in my box into, you know, one of those hub connections, then I get a IP at work. So that's fine. But what I need to do to implement split tunneling is I have to tell my computer and all the computers on my network that if I am looking for, you know, a DNS like www.aol.com, then to tunnel it to my work, because that's where I work, supposedly.
Right.
And if it's not, then just go out the regular internet. But the problem is, when you're doing that, you know, you can't say, like, make sure you do it for all the names. Like, you can't do AOL.com because you have to, you have to pick a DNS to go to, first of all. Like, if you have a private AOL DNS and they have, like, intraweb names, then you need to go through that one, like the AOL DNS. But if it's not, then you don't want to send all your DNS queries automatically to the private one, the AOL DNS. So you have to do it at the IP level. So what you're going to do is have to find out what subnets AOL has for their work, you know, people in your area, or I guess in the whole corporate network. You know, once you find that out, you need to tell your computer if, you know, if either if I go to any of these IPs, then I need to go to this tunnel, or if not, go to the regular internet. But the thing is, if you type in a web page, like I was saying before, you know, you do like some intro web thing for AOL, then you're not going to know where it is. So you should also run your own DNS server that's going to, you know, do the splitting for you. So that DNS server will have both public internet domain names and also be able to resolve, you know, specific intraweb AOL domain names for you. Now, so what I'm going to do is plug in my router that has a VPN connection into another router. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that router is like my normal access to the internet. So when I plug that in, I can then have the router say, like, okay, for all your DNS queries, go to this guy. So I have to run my own DNS router, DNS server.
Right.
Then once you get the IP address, sorry, give me 1 second. Once you get the IP address, then your router will decide which interface to go out of, the VPN one or the regular one.
Right. I think that's even a little bit more detail. What I was thinking more along the lines of, let's go back to remember my scenario of daisy chaining with machine A and machine B.
Right.
Let's say I'm that same consultant, and I work for a security company, machine A, and
right.
I also am being hired out to do pen testing or some kind of security work for AOL box B.
Yeah.
It is entirely possible for me to VPN to box A, because maybe I need to get on there and download tools for my job or fill out some forms or whatever and need that secure access there. But I'm also working on the AOL network doing some scanning or doing some whatever, and I need to have all that traffic also secured. I can have two different software clients running on my box. Now, I think you said earlier that most software clients will not support that easily. But if you have two different software clients, for example, maybe I use a Cisco client to set up the VPN tunnel over to box A, but then I use the Microsoft VPN client to tunnel into box B. Is that a common scenario?
No, you can't. Unfortunately, you can't do that because if each VPN client is configured for full tunneling, then what they're going to do is you know, I mean, they might do it in a slightly different way, but what they're going to do is configure their own virtual interface and then set that in your computer as the default gateway for your local box and make all traffic go to it. So if, let's say, you...
So one's going to take charge of the other. One's going to override the other.
Right, yeah. So one is going to just kick the other one to F. Now, you could write some software yourself, or I don't know if there exists any, but you create the tunnels, but and then in your box, you have to be able to decide which way to route your packets depending on what IPs they are. So your box will have to be a router, and you have to turn on IP routing and make some rules and stuff.
Yeah, and it seems like that seems like a shame that more software clients don't support that or allow that. I understand why for reasons you've explained, but it's certainly not. You, like you said, you could write your own thing to do it, but you would think they would write some support for that into some of these clients, because I honestly don't see that as an unreasonable or unrealistic scenario. This, the first one where it was daisy chaining, yeah, that's a little bit probably weird, but this one, I can see many valid reasons and applications for doing that, so I'm surprised more of them don't support that.
Well, I think the number one reason why they don't do that is because when that happens, you're creating a rogue, like, connection point between two networks that you shouldn't be doing.
Well, that's a very good point. Yeah, you're right. So if one gets owned,
yeah,
so if I get owned through box B, suddenly box A is now vulnerable.
Yeah. So I think for that reason, that's why they don't do that.
That's an excellent point. And yeah.
But you know what I'm going to try? Actually, I was thinking about this the other day, and I haven't tried it yet, but I'm going to see if this works. So I have a MacBook, and I run Windows XP on Parallels because I love Microsoft Office. And what I'm going to try is run the VPN client from inside the VM. And then maybe I think if I do that, the VM will be, you know, just like connected by a VPN into wherever, and the host class can use the network natively.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I make sure we bring that up on a later show. I'd like to know how that works out,
right,
how that comes out.
I'm going to try that as soon as I install a VPN client on the SOS.
Virtualization.
Because what happens for these things, like VMware or Parallels, they have their own, like, virtual interfaces set up for like, your network. Because what they have to do is you can do the bridge network thing, which is another application of tunneling, where they have your packets and your and the guest OS that you're sending tunneled to the regular internet via your host OS, right?
Right.
So if they have that virtual interface set up already, then the mechanism is there for both of them to play nicely. So if I send VPN traffic through that virtual VMware interface or whatever, then with the way they set it up, it shouldn't affect the host OS network connectivity at all.
Right, because it's, well, they're individual, independent stacks. They're two different, unrelated things. But you know what? We're going to have to wrap up, I think. We've got a few minutes to wrap up, but is there anything else that you can think of that we should mention here before we
No, I mean, I think that was the last thing. I'm going to try that, and I'll get back to you.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Virtualization in general is something that a lot of people are starting to... I mean, originally, and I guess still the most popular application is for people who need to do a lot of testing or need to run a lot of several boxes on one machine or something like that. It's very much, a business need for it, I guess. There's not many people using it on an individual level. It's very useful for software application programming, stuff like that, when you want to do multi-environment testing and stuff. But I think a lot of hackers are starting to realize the potential with this, because each one of those, the way virtualization works, is its own independent box, for lack of a better word, a virtual box. And it allows you to do so much testing on your own system, you know, which is... We could go into a whole thing about virtualization. Maybe we should on an upcoming show, but I guess I'll just leave it at virtualization is very cool and something that I think people should really look into a lot, and I am going to put that on our to-do list to talk about an episode about that and some of the applications of it. I know Knot Theory swears by it now, and he uses it for almost everything, so maybe we'll get him on an episode to talk about it. But yeah, for now, I think we're going to wrap it up. I think this episode is going to be like a drinking game, where every time we say the word packet, everybody in the IRC has to take a drink or something.
Because tunneling.
Oh yeah, every time we said packet, everybody has to take a shot or something, because this was a very, very detailed. I hope we did a good job of balancing, explaining it in such a way that it made sense and not just a bunch of techno babble. I think we did a pretty good job. I think at least as a listener listening to you, I think I was able to follow most of that. So hopefully it comes across that well in the show. Let's do some shouts this week, and I'll go ahead and start. I'll go ahead and give a shout-out to Romania because we got that email earlier. The entire country of Romania gets my shout-outs this week. And to my good friend MC Frontalot, he just sent me some lyrics to a new upcoming song of his he's going to be releasing. I don't know how soon, but that is surprisingly... I wish it was released because it would have been a great closing music this week. It's very appropriate for this topic. So shouts out to the front one, the frontingest one. And what do you got for us this week?
I just want to give a shout out to my new buddy Venom. And also, if you have any questions or comments on anything you heard tonight, please, you can email me directly at verbal@binrev.com.
Or you can email us at radio@binrev.com, which is the main address for feedback for the show. Our site of the week is... Well, actually, let's see. We had a site of the week in the first episode, so maybe I should not do it. Now I'm going to give you two sites this week. The second site of the week is powerlabs.org. It's powerlabs.org. It's some cool hardware hacking type... projects and focusing specifically on how to power them and things like that. So if you're into hardware hacking, not totally computer-related stuff, but just some hardware hacking in general, building your own devices, building your own things, that's a pretty cool site to check out. The closing music that we are going to use this week is from MC Chris. I don't think I've ever used this one before. It's called FTW for the win! MC Chris, we're going to close it out, and Verbal, thank you for being on the show again this week.
No problem.
And we will tell everybody that we will see them next week. Same hack time.
Same hack channel.
Biatch.
Tonight at the Alamo Dome, he gets happy go jockey on the big white guy like a donkey eating a waffle. Sweet, sassy molassy, get out the checkbook and pay grandma for the rubdown as the Spurs beat the Heat 86-79. Stewart.
And see the name, my kick is a craze. Play while red, this shit for them heads. You tell it like praise, I'm hella to live. Chemical craze, I'm from hard to face. Around I'm gonna live, rock cause they pay. Eat me those days whenever I'm blessed. My soul's on fire, so call me Nick Cage. Pressing all back, so please call me Christine. Own it again, put others in shame. Here I am, a title I claim, and a world full of blame. I'm Mr. Ducky, lucky enough cause these hoes wanna fuck me. I'm out of job, you know like sports. I want to cry, just got divorced. Like to drink beers and chill with my fans. For the win! Win!
But then Karl Malone says, sweet sassy molassy, you are going to pay a lot. And the cost is going to be prohibitive. Jazz win, 99-93.
Sweet sassy molassy.
Yeah. You like it?
Don't steal it.